put your names on your homeworks and turn them in this way. So what you should have found is that on the funny paper, things line up pretty well. And on the normal paper, things all kind of bunch in here at the beginning. So the fact that those things line up is actually evidence for Kepler's third law, that there's this quadratic cube relationship between the period and the time it takes, which is the time it takes to go around, and the semi-major axes. Questions on anything? So we got an exam next time, 40 questions, 20 true false, 15 short answers, 5 10-point questions. Very similar to what's online. Both the exam for this class 212 and for the other class 211, they both start the same. They're both worth looking over. And by far the best way to study, I think, is to actually work those old exams, come in, talk to me about your answers. That way we can agree on what the right answers are. Other things to think about doing, I think it's a waste of time to reread the chapters. When I make up the tests, I essentially don't look at the book. If I were going to look at something at the book, I'd look at the vocabulary words at the end. They do these studies of intro science courses, and there's typically more vocabulary in an intro science course than there is in your language course. So there are lots of new words to learn. And the other thing that's maybe worth a glance in your textbook is the diagrams, right? There's lots of information in the diagrams to think about. And if you've looked at my tests that are online, there are often lots of things to draw and sketch in those online things. If you want, the answers are online as screencasts, so there are discussions, so you can take a look at those if you want the answers to those old exams. So you go to the lecture section, and the 211 is from last year, and all of the pieces of those screencasts start the same way, A212, T1, and then there are true, false, short answers, and long answers separately. And the same thing for the 211 exam. It also has answers online as screencasts. Typically, we have a chance to get together, and you can ask questions, and that shouldn't be thought of as the only way you can ask questions. You can drop by my office most anytime. There's kind of a problem in that Tuesday afternoon, which is a good time for questions, I'm going to be in lab. So I'm probably going to be moderately hard to find. Tuesday morning might be a good time to catch me, or this afternoon. So help session, kind of before dinner, after dinner. I don't mean any precise times. Vote. So if it's today or Tuesday, vote that way first. So who's for today? 1, 2, 3, 4. Who's for tomorrow? Yeah, the vast majority. So if it's tomorrow, it's got to be basically 8 p.m. or something like that. And I might make it a little bit later than that because I have another class that's doing observing. And it's... I certainly won't be done by 9, but at least I can leave them to do their stuff. Okay. So often listening to other people's questions, even if you don't have your own questions, is good, right? Because you can figure out stuff that you didn't even know you didn't know.
Will that be?
Yeah, it'll be here. Yep. Questions? So we've spent most of this mod going over what we observe in the sky, what are the phenomena we see, and recently we've been looking at explanations for why the sky works the way it does. And the original explanations are due to the early Greeks, Aristotle, Plato, and they hinged on the idea that the heavens were radically different from the earth, and there's good reason to believe that, right? There's nothing on earth that continues in motion after you set it free. But the stars continue to go around perfectly forever, as far as you could tell. So it sure looks like the stars are differently, act differently from the Earth, and that was Aristotle's claim. They were made of totally different stuff. They were made out of perfect stuff, which kind of represented, realized in mathematics. Now, when you got down to details, it was a little bit more complicated than just saying, oh, it's all circles, which is basically what Aristotle did. So, you know, there's some data that you have to crunch to see if the circles work. And the guy who wrote kind of the last book on this was Ptolemy. And in order to make this all work, he needed some kind of funny stuff. So one funny thing he needed was the equant. So the setup is pretty kind of funny. Things are moving in circles, but they're not moving uniformly about the center of the circle. They're moving uniformly about this point that's called the equant. And the Earth, it isn't literally geocentric. The Earth isn't at the center of the circle. It's over to one side. The planets themselves are on circles that are moving around the moving point of the deferent. So we've got equant, deferent, epicycles, all in order to explain this kind of funny loop-to-loop behavior. But it works pretty well. It works, if you want to get the constellation right that the planets are in, it works fine. But it doesn't work as well as you can see with your naked eye. So Copernicus, Aristarchus long before this had postulated a heliocentric model, but Copernicus is the guy who kind of gets the credit for starting this revolution, this 99 years of astronomy that we've been talking about. So at the very end of his lifetime, Copernicus wrote a book that proclaimed a heliocentric system. It still used circles. It was still the same stuff of circles, except now the circles are all going around the sun. So we still had deference, we still had epicycles. Copernicus didn't like the equant, so he didn't use that. And because he didn't use it, it was not a particularly accurate system. And his main claim for it was not that it made better predictions, but rather that it was more natural. The sun kind of belonged at the center. There was a more natural explanation for why the planets seemed to have these loop-de-loop patterns. Retrograde motion. And basically what's happening in retrograde motion is that the Earth is passing by the planets, and so they seem to go backwards, right? So the planets are all moving forwards, but as the Earth passes by a planet, say Mars, Mars seems to go backwards, even though it's going forwards all the time. So we don't need Mars to actually be going in a loop-de-loop pattern in order to make it seem like it's going in a loop-de-loop pattern. And of course, the fact that the sun was in different constellations is not explained by having the sun move. It's the Earth that's moving, so the sun seems to be in different constellations. So instead of having these big objects flying around at high speeds, we have the big object, which since Aristarchus, everyone knew that the sun was the big object. We have the big objects that are stationary and everything's going around them. So usually when we talk about scientific theories, they're supposed to predict stuff better, right? So we have germ theory and then we can make predictions about how disease works. We have evolutionary theory and then we can look at how connections between the various animals' internal organs. But in this case, the heliocentric model doesn't have more accurate predictions. It wasn't really promulgated based on it being a more accurate representation. The idea was that it was in some sense more natural. And of course, Aristotle would have said it's crazy that it's more natural, right? That the stuff upstairs is not like us. It's natural for it to be going in circles. It would be unnatural if it was anything like the Earth. If it were like the Earth, why wouldn't it slow down, right? Anything you set moving on the Earth eventually comes to rest. You throw a rock and it comes back down to Earth. So if the sun is a rock, it should fall. Okay, so Tycho was kind of inspired by an exploding star, a nova, as actually a supernova, because that contradicted what Aristotle said, right? Aristotle said that the heavens were unchanging, but here we had a spot of light which wasn't there before, which brightened and over a series of months dimmed down again. So evidently there was change in the heavens. And if there's change in the heavens, then it really doesn't go along with it being the quintessence. So with that kind of as his motivation, he set doing 20 years of very accurate observations, more accurate than had ever been done before, more accurate than it's ever been done, period, I think, with the naked eye. And again, I say he did it. He actually just oversaw a bunch of unhappy slaves on this island that was off Copenhagen. But he had this book of very accurate observations, and the idea was now to analyze that data and figure out what the data said the system of the world needed to be. So he handed off the data on Mars to this mathematician Kepler, and he made exhaustive attempts to make circles work. I mean, everyone was clued into circles being the natural thing. And after years of every imaginable thing, he gave up on circles, and he found out that something similar to circles, but different, is what the only thing that he could make work. And those were ellipses. So circles are the set of points that are equidistant from one point. Ellipses are the set of points that are the total distance between those two focuses is a constant. And you should be familiar with these descriptions for ellipses. We've got the long axis, which is the major axis. We've got the short axis, which is the minor axis. Half of the major axis is a semi-major axis, and that's what you were plotting today. It's basically the long radius. We have the foci, two focuses. The sun sits at one focus and there's nothing special going at the other focus. And the eccentricity is a measurement of the squashness. So as the eccentricity goes to zero, those two pinpoints get closer and closer to the center of the object. And so we get something that's closer and closer to a circle. And we looked at those planetary orbits, and in particular Mars, and they sure look like circles. They look like circles with the Earth off center, which is exactly, of course, what the equant was talking about. So naked eye, you're going to be a geocentric guy. So it's only when you actually get down to these very accurate measurements that you can see the difference between circles and ellipses.
On that diagram, what determines the length of the string?
So let me phrase it differently. The length of the string determines the eccentricity. Oh, excuse me, the length, there are two things that are involved, the semi-major axis and the eccentricity. If I make the string longer and longer and longer, then it's going to be closer and closer to a circle, because relative to this spacing, the radius is going to be smaller and smaller and smaller. So if you increase the size of the string, it's more circular, and it's going to be overall bigger semi-major axis. So say your question again.
All right. Are those focal points like the focal points for that ellipse?
Yes.
And where does the length of the string come from?
So there are two parameters that describe ellipses, the semi-major axis and the eccentricity, and they're both involved in the spacing of those pins and in the length of the string. So if you change the length of the string, you're going to make something that's overall bigger and has a smaller eccentricity. If you leave the length of the string constant but move the focal points further apart, then you're going to get the same a smaller semi-major axis, but mostly the same, and a bigger eccentricity. Okay? So the length of the string isn't kind of a fundamental parameter. So the fundamental parameters are the shape parameter, that's eccentricity, and the size parameter, which is semi-major axis. Okay, so similar ellipses would have the same eccentricity but different semi-major axes.
So if you give us two focal points, we're not going to be able to determine what the ellipse is because we don't have a straight line.
Correct. But there is if you've looked at a question on the exam, I have you draw ellipses and tell me things about the ones that you have chosen to draw.
Okay.
And I can look at them and see whether you've described your own work.
So,
Right. So the question I think you're probably referring to, I ask you to draw two ellipses, one with big eccentricity and one with large eccentricity. And you can draw anything you want, right? And people will draw different things. But here's something that has a small eccentricity, right? Pretty much a circle. And here's something that has a big eccentricity. And I think I've drawn it so that the semi-major axis of this guy is bigger than it is of that guy. And there's zillions of ways of drawing it. So draw it however you want, but then describe it properly. More questions?
So the eccentricity is A, but what is B, or does it not matter?
So the eccentricity is E, and the semi-major axis is A. And your question was? So B is the semi-minor axis, and it doesn't play an important role, but I thought I would put it on anyway. And there's nothing, it is critical to realize that there's, just as this is an empty focus and there's nothing special happening on this in the solar system, the center of this ellipse, there's nothing special happening. The only place there's something special happening is at this focus, and that's where the sun is. More questions? Okay, so not circles within circles, but these things that look like squash circles seem to be the orbits of the planets. Then we also need the timing of the motion around the orbit of the planet. And this is where Kepler really had to work hard. And we have this idea of the area swept out as the planet goes along in its orbit. So if we think about a line that goes from the sun to the planet, as the planet moves, it's sweeping out some area. Right? So if it's close to the sun, it's sweeping out that area. And the claim of Kepler is that it sweeps out the same area per day. So that if it's far from the sun, this, and it has to have the same area, this thing has to be has to have a small base, since it has a big height. This thing has a small height, so it has to have a big base. They're going to have the same areas. So this is a huge extrapolation on what the solar system is. If you were to look at, we did look at the planetary orbits, and they all just look like circles. The eccentricities, if we exclude Pluto, well, the eccentricity of Mars is about 0.1, which means that the planet is off by just 0.1 of the radius. The sun is off from the center.
Well, they're so relative.
Very circular. You couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I got them, so we can look at them. I'd say it's pretty true. Oops. Third time is a charm. So this is Mars's orbit. Sure looks like a circle. And you really have to have an actual circle that's put on top of it, it still looks very, very circular. So this is an actual circle. Real hard to tell the difference. Very, very close. The reason the equant works is because it's close to reality. Planetary orbits really are pretty much circles with the object in the center just off center. And you remember the way the equant worked is that it gave exactly the same phenomena that when the, let me go back to the exaggerated drawing, just because then I can, where's my exaggerated drawing? You remember that the way the equant worked produced kind of automatically fewer miles per hour here when the planet is far from the sun and more miles per hour here when it's close to the sun. So this equant works really well. Not perfect because they're not circles, but pretty good. And when Copernicus threw out the equant, he kind of screwed up his own model. He didn't like it because it violated the Platonic ideas of perfect circular motion. But perfect circular motion is, the heavens really aren't perfect, they're just rocks that are flying through space. More questions? Okay, so Kepler crunches the data. We've got his laws that the planetary motion, planets move on ellipses. this funny concept of aerial velocity. And what you did today was check that the period squared was proportional to the semi-major axis cubed. So that means that Pluto is not only taking a long time to go around because it has a big orbit, but also because it's going slower.
But the aerial velocity thing is true, or that's what I was asking earlier.
So, pretty true.
Okay. So scientists accept that today.
Well, there are lots of ifs, ands, or buts that can be added in. But let me tell you that we still teach this aerial velocity,
okay,
and it represents something very, very fundamental. What the new idea, and I'm kind of avoiding answering your question because it involves Newton. The new idea from Newton is that it's not just the sun. If we just had the sun and a planet, then the aerial velocity would be exactly constant. Those other planets are going to affect that planet's motion. And so instead of being a perfect aerial velocity, there's going to be, and of course Jupiter's small change compared to the sun. So it's a very small effect that's going to lead to deviations in constant aerial velocity. But they're there and they're measurable.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, so if you look at the timeline again, Galileo and Kepler were contemporaneous. They corresponded with each other. I don't think they ever met in person. And we talked last time about Galileo's work in mechanics. So Galileo kind of slowed down the free fall motion of things that are falling under the force of gravity by using an inclined plane, that inclined plane. And he came to a variety of conclusions. So it turns out there's a mathematical relationship between the distance that the ball rolls and the time it takes to roll to that position. So the idea that there are kind of mathematical relationships behind, formula sort of relationships behind physical reality, is an idea that actually goes back to Pythagoras, who you know for his other theorems. So he invents this idea of acceleration. So we have change in velocity and change in time, the increasing velocity. How many meters per second did the thing increase per second? We stressed last time the throwing balls off of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. The mass of the ball didn't affect the motion. You throw a heavy ball, you throw a light ball, if you throw them with the same velocity, they're going to follow the same trajectory, both in terms of path and in terms of timing. So that, I think, would have come as a surprise to the Aristotelians. Because obviously the heavier object is being pulled harder, you would expect its motion would be different than the lighter object. But somehow or other things work out so that the mass doesn't matter, even though it seems to matter. And I didn't mention last time, but it's worth talking about what's called Galilean invariance. So Galilean invariance is the idea that if you're in an airplane that's going 500 miles an hour, there's no way to tell, right? If you drop stuff, it falls just exactly the way it does on Earth. So Galileo expressed this in terms of ships, right? There weren't airplanes for Galileo. And he commented that if you're on a smoothly going ship, you can't tell exactly how fast you're going. If you were to drop a ball from the mast, it wouldn't fall behind the moving ship. It would fall at the base of the mast, just as if it were at rest. So Galilean invariance is the idea that horizontal velocities kind of don't affect anything. More questions? Okay, so we then started to talk about Galileo's telescopic observations. Galileo didn't invent the telescope, but he cleverly used it, cleverly pretended that he invented it and sold it to the nobles of the time as his invention. But kind of more importantly, he was the first guy at least to record the observations he made of the sky. And the kind of most important observation he made was of the phases of Venus. So in the Aristotelian point of view, Venus is always in front of the sun, going back and forth, so it should always show a crescent phase. But what Galileo saw is that Venus could be in conjunction with the sun as a full phase or as a new phase and everything in between. So if you see a full Venus, it means it has to be beyond the sun. If you see a new Venus, it has to be in front of the sun. And if it's both in front of the sun and behind the sun, then it must be going around the sun. So that's not the point of view, of course, of the Aristotelians. So that was our start. That's about where we quit last time. Questions? So I've got some other points there just to be complete on this board. So as soon as you start using a telescope, you can see lots of things. And one of the complaints about the Copernican system, the heliocentric system, was the Earth was flying fast. And people made the argument that if the Earth is traveling thousands of miles an hour, if you jump, you know, you're going to end up three counties over when you land. Right? So that's violation of Galilean invariance. And how can the Earth hold on to the moon if the Earth is moving thousands of miles an hour? And Galileo didn't have an explanation for why that worked, but he said, look, when I aim my telescope at Jupiter, I see these dots, and they're clearly going around Jupiter, and Jupiter isn't having any problems hanging on to those dots. So whatever the phenomena is that's causing the moons of Jupiter to hang on to Jupiter, same thing will work for the Earth. The Earth is not in an unusual situation. Yeah, so that's Galilean invariance. But that was not an accepted concept. That's why Galileo gets his name in front of that.
When did we figure out like the tides?
So the tides are going to come later, and Galileo actually famously got them wrong. And it's kind of hard for me to understand how he did get it wrong, right? Because you just figure you go and look at the tides and you can see how they work. There are two high tides per day. And I guess the statement is that in the Mediterranean, because it's such a small body of water, the tides are kind of confused. So Galileo claimed that there was one high tide per day. And it's just not the case. So Newton was the guy who got the tides right. But I'm not aiming to talk about that today. More questions? So Newton had the advantage of being basically on the Atlantic, and I guess the tides are a lot more obvious in Britain than they are in Italy. So the other kind of aspect of moons of Jupiter is that in the straightforward Copernican system, it's a little bit odd in that everything goes around the sun except the moon. So why is the Earth lucky to have something that goes around it but the other dots don't? So again, finding the moons of Jupiter showed that Earth doesn't seem to be so unusual a place. Other planets can have moons too. So in the Aristotelian point of view, what's up there is made out of the quintessence, made out of perfect stuff. And so it was expected that those objects would be without blemish. Yeah, you can see some sort of markings on the moon, and that was the idea was that the moon was kind of the dividing point between the perfect and the imperfect. So yeah, the moon could have some blemishes, but Galileo went on to look at those blemishes, and he could actually like calculate the heights of the mountains that were there, and again, the moon seemed to be more or less a place like the Earth, not something that was half and half quintessence and other sort of stuff. And the sun, which everyone thought was perfect, had sunspots on it, has little dark blemishes on them. And those blemishes partake in the rotation of the sun, so we could figure out how fast the sun was rotating. You know, so the sun starts to look more and more like an object like the Earth, as opposed to something that's perfect.
How are they able to observe the sunspots like in that period of time?
So the first thing that's kind of worth commenting on is, although Galileo is often said to have the first who detected sunspots. In fact, the Chinese detected them well before it, but were kind of not part of this academic adventure. And what they did is just hold cloudy pieces of glass in front of the sun, which is dangerous. But if you have a dark enough piece of glass, good welding glass will do it. And the sunspot is big enough, you can see it. So in order to see the sunspots routinely, you need to have a magnified view of the sun. And the easiest way to do that is by image projection. So you still use your lenses, but instead of looking at it, because it's too bright to look at, you project that image on a screen, and then you can see the little dark splotches on that screen. So image projection, I think, is also the best way to look at eclipses, although it's kind of not so exciting. I like to look at it through welding glass, so I can have real-time view. More questions? So the solar system is imperfect, the Earth doesn't seem to be unique, and if you look at the Milky Way, which goes back to the Greeks, people notice that there was this band of light in the sky, you discover that it's made out of zillions of invisible stars, and that kind of didn't make sense again from the Aristotelian point of view. Why have stars that you can't see? Okay, questions on these guys? Okay, so the new guy, Newton. So you all kind of know what happened to Galileo, right? The church took exception to this idea that the sun didn't literally rise and set since the motion stopped according to the Bible. And so he was imprisoned and kept from doing further work. And because of that, kind of progress in astronomy stopped on the continent. So now we shift away from the continent to Britain, which at this point was outside of the influence of the Catholic Church largely, and Newton. And so the kind of important date here is the plague. So when the plague hit London, Newton was at Cambridge, and Cambridge was closed, and Newton went home to think about things. And that's where he came up with all of these ideas, which were explanations for what's going on. And the usual story, and it's in a letter that Newton wrote, so it's not totally made up, is kind of the inspiration for Newton is Newton was looking at an apple and the moon in the same field of view, and at that moment the apple decided to fall, and he asked himself the question, why doesn't the moon fall? And already that question shows that he's not an Aristotelian, right? To an Aristotelian, the moon is totally unlike the apple. There's no reason to compare them at all. But not so for Newton. So what's going on with the moon that allows it to stay up? And the explanation he came up with is based on, usually people talk about three laws. I'm going to talk about four laws. And what's special about Newton is that his laws are not separate for the heavens and the earth. They are laws for motion universally, every place. So there's no distinction to be made between the heavens and the earth. These laws are going to explain all motion on earth and in the heavens, because it's all made of the same sort of stuff, according to Newton. And the laws seem pretty straightforward, I hope. So his first law of motion is that if there's no force on an object, then the object's going to go forever in a straight line at constant speed. And this is kind of a funny relationship because it's not something you can observe, right? So I can put a force on this rock and it'll move for a while, but it doesn't move forever in a straight line. It comes to rest. Right? Aristotle had noticed that everything that you set in motion comes to rest. So this observation, this law, is not based on anything that you can ever see. And of course, the problem is friction. It's hard to get frictionless interactions. And today we can make things that are not, well, not frictionless, have a whole lot less than normal friction. And what we have here is a blower and a rail here that has lots of little holes. So when I turn on this blower, this cart will be suspended by this cushion of air. And so there'll be very little contact between this cart and the frame. So currently, if I get this thing going, it comes to rest pretty quickly. But if I eliminate the frictional force, or at least reduce it drastically, so that this thing is floating, then we can see something like what Newton had in mind. So the first comment is, in order to do this, I had to try and make this thing be level. Because if this thing isn't level, then this thing will just go forever in a straight line, falling down the slope. But you can see that it can't go forever and it loses velocity when it makes those collisions. But things seem to go, if we can eliminate all the forces on something, they're going to go pretty much forever in a straight line. Okay, so straight line, constant velocity motion doesn't need any explanation. It's the natural result of having no forces. So anytime we don't have straight line, constant velocity motion, then we have to look for an explanation. Something has to be causing that motion. And that's Newton's second law. If there are forces, then in order to calculate how the velocity changes, the change in velocity is equal to the net force, right? There might be lots of forces acting. Boy, this chalk is vulnerable. Divided by the mass of the object times the time . So this is called accelerated motion because, of course, the change in velocity divided by the time is the acceleration. So that's Newton's famous sort of law. And if we apply even a tiny force, so these things, I don't know how much these little clips at the end weigh, but they weigh, you know, less than a gram, I would guess. If we apply these forces to this cart, of course, when friction is present, nothing is going to happen because the frictional force can overcome this very small force. But if I eliminate the frictional force, then that external force will cause this guy to move faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. Right? So we get exactly the same sort of motion we saw with the inclined plane. Okay, so first law, no forces, then the speed is going to be constant. If there are forces, then there's going to be a change in the velocity, and the change in velocity depends on the force and the mass. The third law is the one that people usually get wrong on exams because they write action-reaction. And that basically gets no credit on an exam. Because I need to know what those words mean. So the long form of the third law, and you can see why people like to abbreviate it, is if object A pushes or pulls on object B, then automatically it has to be the case that B pushes oppositely but equally on A. So the usual examples that you see of action-reaction have to do with rockets, and I'm not too fond of those. So here's a perfect example of action-reaction. pretty exciting. So what's happening here is this block is pushing on the table, and the table is pushing the block equally up. If there weren't if the table wasn't pushing up on this block, then the block would have to be falling, right? Because the force of gravity is certainly acting on the block. Right? So when I lean on the board, I'm pushing on the board and the board is pushing on me, and those forces have to be exactly equal and opposite. And so with the rocket is pushing on the expanding gas, so the expanding gas is pushing on the rocket. But there doesn't have to be any action in order to have action-reaction come into play. Anytime object B pushes on object A, there has to be an equal and opposite force. Okay, so the sun is pulling on the earth, and the earth is pulling on the sun, equally and oppositely. You may notice that the earth moves a whole lot more than the sun does. That's because if we have the same force, but hugely different masses, we're going to get hugely different effects. Right? So when the semi-truck hits the baby, the semi-truck is hardly affected by it. Right? Weighs a lot. The baby is going to gain a whole lot of velocity quickly. Questions?
So the gravitational pull of the moon on Earth, is that the same as the pull of Earth on the moon?
Exactly the same. Okay. Yep. And not just for gravity, but for any imaginable force. And that's kind of an impressive feature of Newton. He didn't make this restriction on only the forces he knew. He said this had to apply to all forces, even the ones that would be new to him, like electricity or the nuclear force. And it turns out that some of these are, Einstein makes some slight corrections to these over time. But as far as we can tell, this is the one Newton law that remains exactly true today. Here's another question.
Because if the gravitational pull of the moon is the same as it is to Earth, then the reason the moon goes around us is because our masses are different?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to comment on is that there aren't unmoved movers. So if the Earth moves the moon has to move the Earth too. If the sun moves the Earth has to move the sun too. So we have the following example, right? So you're about to see your professor move the world, move the Earth in its total. Did you notice anything? So I pushed on the Earth and the Earth pushed on me and we both had to move. The Earth, in spite of this, the Earth weighs hugely more than me. So the change in velocity of the Earth is much smaller than the change in velocity of me. So if we look in detail at the motion of the Earth and the Moon, think about the Earth being here and the Moon being there. They both are going around in circles. And there's a teeter-totter point between the Earth and the Moon, which is fixed, and they're both going around in circles about that point. Now, it turns out that the Earth is so massive that the teeter-totter point is actually inside of the Earth, but the center of the Earth is still going around in a circle. More questions? Okay, so these are the usual three laws. I claim there's another law that is worthy of being included on this list, and that's the one law that Newton figured out how it worked. That's the force of gravity. So Newton said if we have two objects, famous object A and object B, might be the sun and the earth, might be the earth and the moon, might be the apple and the earth, any two objects, you can calculate the force on those objects because they are equal and opposite forces, right? So that common force is given by the product of the masses divided by the distance between their centers squared. And then there's basically a unit conversion factor, G, that goes into that, a constant G, universal constant G. Okay, so you can see from the formula that the, you know, whether I multiply the mass of A times the mass of B or the mass of B times the mass of A, I get the same result. And that's indicative, again, of Newton's third law, that A and B have to have a share a common force. Okay. So remember the question that Newton originally asked himself was why the moon didn't fall down the way the apple did. And I'm not sure it's clear that we've made any progress to answering that question. But let's take a look at Newton's explanation. This is actually an illustration from Newton's book, just to show that this is how Newton thought about it. So let me comment that these gizmos, if you want to play with them, you can see that they're in Astro, the usual Astro directory for this class, and then slash slides. And, you know, so there are various things that you can play with. This is one that has to do with ellipses. So I can make a very circular ellipse, or I can make a very squashed ellipse. And the semi-major axis affects the overall size of this orbit. Okay, so here's Newton's picture. You can see the same picture there. What I have here, what I imagine here, is I've got a cannon that's up high on a mountaintop. And if I fire that cannon, it goes for a while and it's going to crash into the Earth. If I shoot it faster, it's going to go further. And if I shoot it faster still, it's going to go even further. But if I get the speed just right, not quite right because there's another mountain there. If I get the speed just right, it can always be falling but never hitting. So in all circumstances, this cannonball is falling, but it's not hitting anything. Because the distance it moves, the deflection that it suffers from its horizontal straight line motion that it would have absence any force, just makes up for the curvature of the Earth. Okay. The other thing that's worth commenting about here is a word that is similar to a word that you know, which would be fine with me if you deleted it from your vocabulary, because it doesn't exist. And that's centripetal. Right? Sounds a lot like this word centrifugal, which I bet you're familiar with before. So centripetal means center pointing, as opposed to centrifugal, which means outward pointing. So I repeat, the word centrifugal applies to nothing. So you can delete it from your vocabulary without loss of anything. So what we have here is something that is moving at a constant speed because there is a force, namely the force of gravity, that is always bending it towards the center. So the force that's required to bend something into a circular motion is called a centripetal force. Right? So here I have a ball on a string, and the string is tight. And you know you can't push with a string, so this string must be constantly pulling this ball around. So in this case, this ball is making circular motion because of the center-pointing centripetal force that's caused by the string. All that's different here is that gravity is the string.
If you were to increase the speed more, would it fall away from Earth, or would it be more difficult?
Well, let's see, right? I hope I didn't do it too much. Let's go back a little bit. So Kepler said that the orbits of the planets had to be ellipses, and that's still true for this cannonball. If I time things just right, the ellipse is a circle, and we have circular motion of the cannonball. If I miss, then the ellipse intersects the surface of the Earth, and I have a crash. If I get a little bit of extra velocity, then the distance between the cannonball and the Earth increases for a while, and the object slows down, and then it falls back to Earth.
So will it always fall back, no matter how hard you shoot it?
Well, we just saw that if I shot it at 12, it said it isn't coming back. So the path is deflected, but it has what's called an escape velocity. It's moving fast enough that what goes up doesn't come back down. So we can shoot space probes to Mars. We can escape the Earth's gravitational field by going fast enough. And it turns out there isn't a huge difference between the orbit velocity for the Earth and the escape velocity for the Earth. So it's about 17,000 miles an hour to orbit the Earth, and it's about 25,000 miles an hour to escape the Earth. A factor of the square root of 2 difference. Okay. So let me comment that people are often fooled by watching NASA videos, right? So if you watch, if you watch spacecraft taking off, they go up. And so you might think that the main evidence for what NASA needs to do is to just go up high. And it turns out it's pretty easy to go up high. The V2 rockets that the Germans were firing at England went higher than the astronauts are currently orbiting. So going up high is relatively easy. What you need to do is to go sideways fast. You need to accelerate sideways at 17,000 miles per hour so that the distance you fall every second is made up by the distance that the Earth curves. So even though the rockets go up, once they get outside of the air friction that goes along with the Earth's atmosphere, they run their engines this way to accelerate up to 17,000 miles an hour.
I was just going to say, so centripetal force is a force applied to the center
of the orbit. So a centripetal force is a force towards the center that's making something move in a circle. And it's in contrast to centrifugal, which is a non-existing force that you believe in that pushes your books to the side when you go around in a corner in your car. There's no such force. The books are just trying to go in a straight line and the door of the car hit them. More questions? Well, there are more of these little gizmos we can play with. So you remember a while ago we had the guy throwing up the ball, so I can now throw this ball up and it comes straight down. And if I throw it harder, it goes up further. So the harder you throw it, the higher it goes. You might notice that it seems to kind of hover for a while at long's distance. That is to say that the force gets smaller as we get further from the Earth, and so the acceleration is less, and so the falling rate is less, but it's still a matter of what goes up that comes down. But if I push this thing fast enough, it's gone. It's not coming back. Okay, so escape velocity is what's necessary to go on forever. Orbit velocity is what's necessary to orbit it. And I can do the same thing kind of here. I can drop rocks on the Earth, which of course isn't very healthy for the Earthlings. But notice that nothing much seems to happen initially because the force is small. We get very fast acceleration as we get closer to the Earth because the force is bigger. So the force is small at great distances from the Earth, so not much is happening. But we're building up speed and crunch time. It's interesting that it always hits Africa. So here's the the kind of situation. We have planets that are going in orbits, and we said before that the consequences of Kepler's third law is that the innermost planets have more miles per hour and less time to go around. And what Newton did is allowed us to actually figure out how that depends on the mass of the sun. So if the sun were lighter, then everything goes around slower, but still the innermost thing is going to be the fastest thing. Okay, questions on... So, let's first of all just kind of bring back common sense notions. If I have this thing going at a moderate speed, the string isn't all that tense. If I have a very tense string, then it has to go around faster. So if I increase the mass of the sun, then I'm going to have the planet going around faster if it's going to stay at the same radius. So yeah, if I punch the mass up, these guys start really going. Yeah, so as long as there's a gravitational force, it's in an equilibrium situation. And in order to escape, you have to have an escape velocity, and these guys just have the orbit velocity. More questions? So one of the things Newton actually worried about is this is a law of universal gravitation. So it's not just that the sun is pulling the Earth around. Jupiter, all of the planets are acting on the Earth. And you might kind of worry that maybe over time things would get out of sync and the Earth would be sent careening into the sun or out into to deep space. So the stability of the system, given that everything interacts with each other, is a problem until the 1800s in Laplace. More questions? So this idea of a centripetal force is really central to what we want to talk about. And so the overall claim is that if something's moving in a circle, say my ball is moving in a circle around a fixed point, in order to be absent that string, if I were to cut that string, it would go forever in a straight line, right? So that string is constantly pushing it towards the center of the circle. It's bending its motion from this straight line motion to motion that is going around and around and around. So how can we get a handle on this? So an argument that's actually due to Newton to try and figure out how this works is to kind of figure out how pool would work if we were to have lots of edges to our table. So you know, if you have a normal, let's have a square pool table, you could imagine a pool shot that kind of went like that. And of course, at every one of these bounces, the ball is being pushed that away. So now if you think about having more and more edges to your table, and I won't try and do this accurately, you could imagine a pool shot kind of like this, where again, at every bounce, the object is being pushed towards the center, and of course, in the intermediate regions where there's no force, it's going in a straight line. And if we just kind of take the limit of getting more and more sides to this circle, we can get a handle on how this force is required to push things around. So again, it's kind of the opposite of how, for example, how Kepler thought, right? So you don't need angels to push the planets around the orbit. You need the angels to be pushing the planets towards the center of the orbit in order to cause circular motion. So things can always be pulled down like the apple, but not hit the Earth if they're moving fast enough sideways. Okay, so how does this work? Well, with a little bit of algebra, which I'm not going to bother to do, you can show that the acceleration of something that's moving at a constant speed depends on that speed divided by the radius of the circle it's going in. So if we're moving slowly, there's not much acceleration. If we're moving in a very tight circle, there's a lot of acceleration. And if you remember what Newton said, he said that the acceleration was the force divided by the mass. And he said that the force of gravity, let's talk about the Earth and the Sun, the force of gravity on the Earth was given by Newton's gravitational constant times the mass of the Sun times the mass of the Earth divided by the distance between the Earth, the centers of the Earth and the Sun squared. So if we're talking about the acceleration of the Earth, the first thing you'll notice that happens is that the mass of the Earth cancels out. Right, so that's what Galileo discovered, right? Masses are all the same. Motion is all the same independent of mass. So if we replace the Earth by a feather that's moving at the same speed, it'll continue in exactly the same orbit as the Earth has. The mass really doesn't matter. And if we continue this a little bit further, so we have the velocity squared divided by r is g times the mass of the Sun divided by r squared. The velocity of something is the distance it travels, which is the circumference of the circle, 2 pi r, divided by how long it takes to go around, which is the period. So if I plug those things in, so what I've got is 2 pi r divided by the period squared, all over r has to be g times the mass of the Sun divided by r squared. So there's an r here, I can get rid of one of those r's there. I got two r's up there. So I've got 2 pi squared, these two r's, and that one. And the period squared can come up over there. So this is exactly Kepler's law, that the period squared is proportional to the radius of the orbit cubed. And the proportionality constant depends on the mass of the object in the center. Okay, so we can weigh the Sun by knowing the orbit of the Earth. We can weigh the Earth by knowing the orbit of the Moon. We can weigh Jupiter by knowing the orbits of the moons of Jupiter. If we have two stars that are going around each other, and we do pretty commonly, we can weigh those stars by looking at the motion. We can figure out the mass of the thing in the center by applying this version of Kepler's laws. Right, so in the case we just looked at, the radiuses of these planets were constant, but say I increase the mass of the Sun, that means the period has to get a lot shorter in order to add up to exactly what it did before. So when I pushed the slider up to increase the mass of the Sun, the periods of those planets all got a lot less with time. Okay, another way of dealing with this without using periods is in this version. If we cancel out one of those r's, we get that the velocity is the square root of gm over r. So that Pluto has a greater distance from the Sun, so it has a smaller velocity. Okay. Well, let's talk about a phenomena which often bothers people, and that's why the astronauts float when they're in the space shuttle. What's going on there? So first of all, let me give the wrong answer. It's not because they're far away from the Earth. They're just 100 miles up. The force of gravity on those astronauts is very much the same as it is on us. So moving fast sideways is basically not relevant, right? So Galileo says if we take the space shuttle and stop it, it should have the same sort of experience. So if they're floating in the space shuttle when it's moving fast sideways, they'd be floating in the space shuttle if it were stopped. Having said that, we have to be a little bit careful. If we stop the space shuttle, it'll be the same for a while, but not too long afterwards they'll crash into the Earth. Yeah, so remember that mass doesn't affect trajectory. So the space shuttle itself, it's a hugely massive object, and the astronaut, they have radically different masses, but according to Galileo, they're going to move with exactly the same trajectory. Right? The pencil that the astronaut releases weighs a whole lot less than anything, but mass doesn't matter. They're going to follow exactly the same trajectory. They'll seem to be staying there 1 foot in front of the astronaut's nose. Okay, so it's not because the force of gravity is small up there. Yeah, the force of gravity does get small when you move away from the Earth, but they're not that far up. They're just 100 miles up. So the force of gravity is very much the same up there as it is here. The reason they are floating is because mass doesn't matter. Mass cancels out of the equation. So you might know that they can simulate weightlessness by doing the thing that I just said you probably didn't want to do with the space shuttle. You just drop something, and then the trajectory of the pencil and the aircraft and the astronaut will all be the same, namely down, and things will seem to float. So if you want to simulate weightlessness, you just go to that elevator and cut off the cable that connects it, and for a fraction of a second, you and the pencil can experience weightlessness.
So if the space shuttle is orbiting, once they've achieved the speed, can they just turn the engines off?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the very limited fuel aboard the space shuttle. Yeah. Nothing is required to push you forward. Nothing is pushing the planets forward.
So the only way that it would actually fall is if you forcefully stopped it in place or slowed it down.
Yeah, so all that they do is they fire retro rockets, which reduces the velocity by a few percent. And then they have a circular orbit that is just a few hundred miles above the surface of the Earth. So it's relatively speaking, it's much closer than those two circles. And if they slow down just a little bit, then their elliptical orbit will intersect the surface of the Earth, and they can slow down then in the Earth's atmosphere and land. So big rockets to get you going 17,000 miles an hour fast, and then small rockets because you only have to slow down by, say, 10% in order to change your orbit enough to intersect the Earth's atmosphere. And then friction will do the rest.
How do you achieve that speed initially, and then how do you keep from continuing to accelerate?
So the only way you accelerate if there's a force on you. So if you turn off the rocket engine, there's not going to be any rocket force on you.
Okay, so how do you get to 17,000?
You just push hard. And so anything that'll make you go 17,000 miles an hour will work just fine to orbit. So Jules Verne envisioned big guns shooting things at actually escape velocity to reach the moon. And that'll work fine if you have a big enough gun. There's nothing special about rockets. Any force. So downstairs there was a discussion about using lasers to make spacecraft move. So anything that can apply a force and can get you up to 17,000 miles an hour is all you need. There's nothing special about rockets that are required. More questions? Okay, so I already erased it. So we said Tuesday at 9, right, for the help session.
you look at my home?
Yeah, I can, but to email.